Hey everyone, Chat Cemetery is back. I'm your host, Deanna Chapman, and today I am joined once again by Terry Menard, and we are talking about Mr. Mercedes Season 1. Terry, I decided to break up these newer seasons going forward simply because I did The Dead Zone and Under the Dome as one episode for each of those, and it was just so much, and even though Mr. Mercedes, the seasons are only 10 episodes, it still felt like trying to cover 30 episodes in the span of roughly an hour would be a challenge given the types of characters in this story.
Yeah, I can't imagine trying to cover an entire like one of the long seasons, because The Dead Zone was back when the seasons were a lot longer too, wasn't it?
Yeah, I watched like 80 episodes or something of The Dead Zone.
That's bonkers. I can't imagine doing that.
But at the same time, I'm like, would I have wanted to spend 6 episodes on The Dead Zone?
I mean, fair. That is absolutely fair. Sometimes the television adaptations of King's work are not the best, particularly at that era.
Yeah, I was definitely more of a fan of the miniseries stuff because you could kind of get in and out with that in a few hours. But, you know, Mr. Mercedes surprised me with how much I enjoyed it, because what they're doing is they are essentially covering each book from the trilogy in the 3 seasons. They are shaking things up a little bit, but season 1 really is an adaptation of the Mr. Mercedes novel. They do change some things up, but overall I thought they really captured the essence of sort of our main 4 characters, if you will, with Bill, Holly, Jerome, and Brady.
Yeah, I also was surprised coming into this because I watched The Stand, the CBS All Access adaptation, didn't care for it. Watched Lisey's Story, which I thought was overall decent. I just thought it was really slow. So coming into this, I had, you know, back to back, not the best adaptations that I've been watching. And so I was a little worried about this, but I was pleasantly surprised. This is a really good adaptation. I think some of it kind of feels a little workmanlike in terms of the filmmaking of it. It definitely has like a television aesthetic to it. And there's some things in it that kind of bothered me in terms of how they decided to end some scenes with like just sort of trailing off into the credits. Well, the supposed credits, because this was on Audience, as opposed to like actually definitively ending a scene. So there was some it hit or miss by that. But overall, I really enjoyed this season, and I really enjoyed getting to spend time with these characters.
Yeah, and to talk about some quick character changes, you know, Bill's neighbor Ida wasn't like a massive part of the books, if at all. I'm like, I don't really remember this character.
I don't think she was in the books.
Okay.
I was trying to figure that out myself, and from what I could see from some like interviews that I did look up, they might have created her, or at least boosted her up to be like a more interesting character than maybe a one line or two in the book, maybe.
Yeah, I felt like if she was in the books at all, it was definitely in passing sort of thing, as you typically do with your neighbors, you know, hello here or there. But, you know, Barbara is the character who I think really takes a back seat in this series so far. And that was an interesting choice because it kind of takes away this one element of Jerome's character a little more. But I still like Jerome overall. But, you know, in the Mr. Mercedes book especially, you know, he's the smart high school kid. He's getting ready to go off to Harvard. You know, his sister doesn't seem to completely hate him, which is kind of an odd dynamic for like the older brother, younger sister thing, at least from what I've gathered. I'm an only child, so I can't really speak entirely to that. But in the book, you really got this sense of this sibling connection, where in the show, because Barbara only just pops in here and there, she's maybe in a few scenes in season 1. It's really not a whole lot.
I think that they really focused really heavily on Bill and his story in this. And I think probably to the benefit of being 10 episodes and being such an intricately plotted out story, probably they tried to cut a bit of the chaff. And unfortunately, Barbara is one of the characters that gets sidelined. And Jerome is in general kind of gets sidelined. He just sort of shows up as like the tech support, and he does get a little bit more involved as the season goes on. But on one hand, I was happy that his character, his character in the book kind of bothered me a little bit, because like he was trying to, you know, play into the stereotypes of the kind of black African-American kid. And so he was like speaking, you know, talking a little bit in jive and that kind of thing to make fun of it. Whereas here he just feels like more of a real person. So I did appreciate that. But yeah, we don't get to see a whole lot of his family outside of his father talking about how, you know, I don't want him working for you because I have sacrificed so much to get him to go to Harvard and to give him a life that I want. So like we get a little bit of that, and I think it plays into the class dynamics of the show. But in terms of being a rich character with his family and his sister, definitely they kind of negated that, I think.
Yeah, and they end up making some further changes, which I believe don't come up until season two technically, so we'll save those thoughts there. But I think overall, well casted, you know. I think they did a very nice job finding actors who would play all of the characters well. And look, you know, with Ida being added and being played by Holland Taylor, I'm just like,
oh my gosh,
this is amazing. At first, I wasn't entirely sold on it, because when you kind of introduce a character who wasn't a big part of the story and the source material, that can be very tricky, because it can be very, very hit or miss, and they just hit with this one.
I loved her in this. In fact, I wanted more of her. First of all, I love that we have an older woman that is commanding her sexuality, and she is confident in her sexuality, and she's confident in her body and that kind of stuff. I was so happy that we got to see that kind of character here, and I loved her and her and Bill's relationship. I also felt bad for her as this series goes on, because she is like that sort of right in front of your face love interest that she could potentially be for Bill. And yet he is in this season all about Janie, and she thinks that she's getting, you know, getting to know him. And then there'll be like a reveal where they're at, where Bill and Janie are at a restaurant, and you can just see the hurt in her eyes, because she's like, hello, I'm all of this, and it's still not enough. And I love that extra dynamic that it's added to it.
But she doesn't really let it affect her for too long, because, you know, she is Bill's neighbor. She understands that she is going to have to continue seeing this man all the time. And then, you know, you have the tragic event that happens where Brady just blows up Bill's car and Janie's the one in it. And, you know, we're obviously skipping quite a bit ahead here, but I think that one event really is the catalyst for this season and, in a way, the series.
I agree. I think it's sort of there's a sadness to this series, and there's a kind of an ongoing tragedy of how we can see Brady and the horrors that he's committed, and the way that the kind of single-minded focus that Bill has to get Brady, and the kind of downward spiral that we see in this season and then also into the next season, which we'll talk about later. But the deaths that happen that feel so needless in a lot of ways, and it just, yeah, it was such, even though I knew it was coming, it still hit me really hard, particularly because, I mean, talking about cast, Mary Louise Parker, hello, I love her.
Yeah, I was very impressed with the quality of the show, and I know you mentioned a few production things, but I think for the cast they were able to get, and, you know, this isn't something that necessarily feels like a Law and Order, even though it is very much about Law and Order in a sense, but it's not quite that procedural drama, despite having all of those elements, and you get even more into that kind of feeling with season two. But in season one, it's really this mystery drama kind of thing. And, you know, when I first heard about the Bill Hodges trilogy and that it was going to be sort of King's big detective work, I was a little hesitant, because I was like, okay, I at that point hadn't read the hard case crime stuff when I heard about the trilogy coming out and the show. So I wasn't entirely sold on it. And because this was on Audience Network, I didn't bother watching it until, you know, you and I were discussing it for the podcast. So I, went into this not really having any sort of expectations, not really knowing what the quality was going to be like, because I had never watched anything on AT&T's audience network. And I think even with some of the things they do production-wise and some of the big changes they make from the books, they still make it so that at its core, you feel for Bill. It pushes him towards Holly, and you find Holly sort of endearing, even though she's constantly awkward. Like, her social skills, you know, are definitely not something to aspire to. But then you have, you know, Jerome, who maybe we don't connect with quite as much in this as we did in the books. You really end up loving Ida, and then you really, really, really end up hating Brady. And I think that's kind of exactly how you want to feel about all of these characters. And because of Janie's death, you connect with her, but at the same time, you kind of feel the way Bill does, or at least I did, where you definitely feel that she was taken away too soon.
Yeah, and I think the casting of Mary Louise Parker in that role plays into that, where it's like she's a big name. I mean, this is a cast full of big names, but like, she is a big name. She had her, you know, she was on Weeds. She has like her the kind of built-in audience. And so the fact that, if you don't know how the story is going to unfold, the fact that she is in here, gets introduced in the second episode, and then before the season's up, she's gone, it really does hit hard. And I also wanted to point out as well, kind of, you mentioned this audience network aspect of it, and I was in the same boat. Unless you have, I think it was like Dish or AT&T as a service, you don't get audience in the States. I think it was played elsewhere outside of the United States. But like, if you were here in the United States and you didn't have audience, you weren't watching this show. And so it was sort of a non-entity for me, because I'd never had the opportunity to watch it until, you know, audience went away and then Peacock picked it up. So I also was unsure what the quality was going to be, but they have not even just in front of the camera, but behind it too, because you have Jack Bender directing the episodes, and was involved with Lost. You have Dennis Lehane, the mystery writer, who wrote Mystic River and Gone Baby Gone, I think it's called, and Shutter Island. So he's written some of the episodes, and I think he wrote probably my favorite episode of this season. So you there's so much talent, and you can see that the money that actually went in to make this a successful thing. It's just a shame that not as many people had access to audience.
Yeah, it's one of those adaptations where I'm like, huh, it's very interesting that this is the place that picked this up and had the rights and everything, because a lot of what we're seeing lately is these big streaming platforms picking up a lot of the adaptations. You know, with HBO, you have The Outsider, you have Castle Rock on Hulu, you have Lisey's Story on Apple TV Plus, all of which are very easy to access and more often than not have free trials. Whereas with audience, it's like you had to have cable to get it, which I feel like hindered how many people, like you said, were able to watch this. And now that I've watched the first two seasons, that really feels unfortunate. I personally bought, like, I think I have the DVD set for season one, and then they were like, oh, now that you bought this, we're going to release it on Blu-ray. I was like, oh, thank you. How kind of you.
Of course.
So then I have the Blu-ray for season two and three, because I waited long enough.
Yeah. And if you're out there and you want to watch it, it's streaming on Peacock. So
yeah, now it is, which is great. Hopefully more people will watch it then. And, you know, hopefully if you're listening to this, you have watched it or you don't care about it being spoiled. But Terry, I do want to discuss some of the big changes aside from Barbara that they made in this, because Brady's sort of final act in this season doesn't feel as big, because it's at a much smaller venue. You know, it's at this sort of art exhibit, rec center opening kind of thing. And it's outdoors. It's not a super, super big place. It's just kind of like I said, your neighborhood rec center kind of place. Whereas in the book, his big bombing plan is going to happen at a sold out concert for this boy band whose name I can't remember, because it was definitely made up and not a real one.
Yeah, I think that that might be a case of a money issues, because it definitely felt very small in this case. And it had been a long time since I read Mr. Mercedes. I read that when it first came out. So we're talking years ago that I read it, and I had to go back to the Wikipedia because, like, I remember this being a bit of a bigger thing.
Yeah.
And because I'm watching this, and I'm like, okay, you have a spoken word artist, you have a harpist or a violinist, I think, that was playing. I'm like, this isn't a statement. You're not making a big statement with this particular thing in comparison to the book and in comparison to the event that set off this entire string of violence. It felt a bit muted once we got to the end, and I think that was probably my bigger disappointment, is the way it kind of just unfolded at the end, just sort of kind of fizzled in my opinion, compared to the more climactic ending of the book. But
yeah, and I think, you know, the Janie episodes were definitely the strong section of this season, because, you know, she's only in 6 episodes and each season is 10, so we kind of had this little buffer on the front end and the back end of the season where she just wasn't in it really. And I think when you have an actress like her and a character who is so important to Bill's life, and then you kind of take the end and change it so it's not as impactful, you're going to have this sort of sense of, oh, that's it?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And that's disappointing. It's also, I didn't realize, and I can't remember how long it takes for her to get introduced in the book, but I forgot until I was watching this that Holly isn't in it until the last, like, 4 episodes, I think. I think she gets introduced in, like, episode 6. And you can tell, like, when she comes on the screen, as much as I love, and I think it's a better performance in The Outsider, in terms of, like, the characterization, I loved Holly in this. And she adds a much-needed dimension to the sort of grumpy old man aspect of Bill. And so when you have her, and then you also have Janie leaving at the same time, it almost feels like they sort of interjected this as, like, okay, we're going to go from one woman side character to another woman side character. And it felt... I don't know, it felt a little bit more manufactured here than I remember it being in the book, but I love that she is in it, and I wanted her to be in it a lot more.
I think what happened was she should have had a little more overlap with Janie, just so the transition maybe would have been a little smoother between those two characters. And obviously it's not a transition in the sense that, you know, they were going to play the same roles in Bill's life by any means, but
right.
Just the importance of each of those characters, it really felt like they were both going to sort of hold equal weight. And I think they've proven that to be the case.
Yeah, especially as we get into past the season and Holly becomes more of an interesting character. But here it definitely, I agree. I wish that she was introduced a little bit earlier so that it doesn't feel as abrupt, where it's like she's introduced, Janie dies, now we're with Holly and him. It just, I don't know. It just felt a little chintzy for me.
Yeah. I feel like we have gone roughly 20-ish minutes here and barely said anything about Brady, which I think goes to show just how strong this cast is. And Brady is one of those characters you are always meant to hate. There are supposed to be moments where you kind of sympathize with him, and I think there are those, but they aren't being like, oh, hey, we're going to make you feel really, really bad for this character. It's like, no, you're just kind of going to be like, oh, he's that guy, you know, and you're going to feel bad for him a little bit, but then it instantly goes away just because of something he does or something his mom does. And oh my goodness, that whole storyline. Oh boy.
Wow. Yeah. the season really does a good job of not trying to make you empathize with him. I think, as you said, there's definitely some sympathy, particularly as you see the sort of ancestral relationship that it's suggested the mom started. This isn't something where he started it. It seems like that this is something that she's been doing his entire life. And so you get some sympathy from that, and it's incredibly uncomfortable, but he does everything in his power to kind of negate any of those little moments of like, ooh, I kind of feel bad for him, because he is a terrible human being in this through and through. Every aspect of when he could potentially do something good, he takes the opposite turn. In particular, I'm thinking about the moment that I was like, no, there is definitely no redeeming for him, is the episode where his mom is trying to get better and she throws away her alcohol. She tries to go get her job back. She tries all this kind of stuff. She's clean headed. And he needs to have her screwed up. And so he buys top shelf vodka under the guise that, like, no, we're going to wean you off of it and not be cold turkey. But that is not what he's doing. He knows that she's going to take one sip and be right back into being that docile sort of character that's not poking her nose into his business that he can control. And it's that moment that it's like, oh, you are a horrible person through and through. There's no redeeming for you.
Yeah, I know that weaning someone off of something is definitely used in addiction. And in this case, it was very clear that it was malicious intent on his part. It wasn't out of caring for her. And granted, I understand why he wouldn't care for her, given what she has done to him. And it was one of those moments where you're like, okay, we understand what your mom has done to you. And neither of you are good people. So all of those scenes are just so filled with hatred almost, because you can tell that Brady hates his mom, which I don't really understand why in this instance, if he's working two jobs, he doesn't just like go get his own place. But, you know, I mean, obviously that's in the book too and everything. And it just kind of plays into his character and how he feels like his mother has a hold on him, even though it kind of feels like there's not really a need for it.
Yeah, and I think what that scene in particular kind of shadows on his character is that he sees her in that moment as an annoyance. Because the entire episode, he's like trying to find out where she was. She took his car. You know, she's showing some sort of independence, I guess, from him. And he can't have that. And so at that point, it's like, no, I need to get you drunk again. And like you said, there are ways of weaning someone off of addictive substances where you lower the doses, but that is not his intent. And he just wants her to not leave the house and not like be an annoyance. And it's that point where it's like, you are just not good. But also what I did love about this, and it shows up in episode 4 in particular, which is also written by Dennis Lehane. It kind of contrasts two ideas of toxic masculinity here, where you have this character they introduced called Ryan, who has been picking on Lou, who works with Brady at the electronics store, and he's a white supremacist. He is openly bigoted. He calls Lou a slur. Like, he is that sort of outward, antagonistic, bad person. And the episode does a good job of contrasting that sort of like outward hostility vice the kind of inward hostility that Brady has inside of him, because he does do something, you know, there's retribution here. He does stick up for Lou by killing Ryan, but there's this, he's a quietly coiled bundle of similar rage. It's just not on the outside like Ryan's character is. It's more controlled and inward directed. And I think the episode and this season kind of does a good job of sort of deconstructing that male rage in a way, in different ways.
Yeah, it's like opposite ends of the spectrum of it almost. You have someone who is just so confident that no one's ever going to do anything about what he's saying or doing, that he's just going to say whatever he wants to whoever he wants. And then you have Brady, who is like the quiet brooding type and kind of has this school shooter persona. And you see how having that all bottled up ends up for Brady. You know, he ends up wanting to bomb this public event. He burns his own house down with, you know, his mom and his boss inside. So you really can't trust anything he thinks or feels about other characters, because you know that he's going to do something that kind of cancels all of those feelings out, whether he cares for his mom, whether he cares for Lou, whatever it is, it's all going to get canceled out because of how terrible he is. So, you know, any sympathy you feel for him is almost always instantly taken away. And even though you don't feel bad that he killed a white supremacist necessarily, who was clearly, you know, kind of gearing up to do something, they made it seem like, because he was like visiting these forums and, you know, kind of preparing himself, I guess, in a way. But with all of these characters, even Lou, you know, plays such a crucial role in this show, and more so later on. But in this season, you know, she's the only one who is actually a friend to Brady. And, you know, it's not like they hang out outside of work or anything, but she sees a different side of Brady that he doesn't really let anyone else see.
Yeah, and I do want to give a shout out to the actress Breida Wool, who I think she's a phenomenal actress. I think she typically puts in a lot of more subtle performances. I remember watching her in the Lifetime series Unreal and absolutely loving her in that. And then at Sundance this last year, I got to see Mass, which she plays a small role in. And she is just, she has a lot of charisma, and she's able to just kind of capture the eye, even when she is turning out these more subtle, not necessarily larger than life performances. And I think she does a fantastic job of Lou. And I think she kind of rounds out that character in a way that I didn't get from the book.
Her outrage in this is such a stark contrast to Brady's outrage, because even though they both have this anger, hers is for a totally different reason. Even though they're both outsiders, you know, she is willing to stand up for herself and it gets her in trouble, whereas Brady just kind of keeps to himself, and then he concocts these master plans that, you know, may or may not go as planned. And when the house was on fire and they're like, oh, by the way, there was a tunnel, I was like, of course there is, because, you know, we still have episodes left. So, you know, that didn't really feel like a twist, and it never really felt like it was going to last long, because it's like, okay, of course they're going to check the dental records. They're not just going to be announcing, oh, hey, the Mr. Mercedes killer is dead. And, you know, yeah. I think with that whole storyline, it still works because you're getting a look at just how far Brady is willing to go.
Yes, absolutely. And speaking of kind of the actors behind it, the choices that Harry Treadaway makes in terms of the physicality of his character sometimes made me really laugh. I'm thinking back to, there's a scene where he kind of is talking with his manager, Roby, in the bathroom, and he's like kind of giving him his sob story about his life, and he's crying, and Roby's like, you know, go dry your eyes. And so instead of doing what a regular person would do and grab a paper towel, he tilts up the hand dryer so he can dry his eyes with the dryer. And it's just like, what? Who does that? And I love that little characterization that he adds to the character, that, you know, that he is just working at it at a beat to a different drum this entire time.
I don't think I've even ever touched one of those to turn it the other way.
No.
So it was just one of those little things where you're like, oh, okay, that's kind of strange. And it just adds to his strangeness. Yes. Overall, too. You're just like, what is wrong with this guy? And you have moments where he acts normal, but he really gets inside his own head, and that's when you're like, okay, something's about to happen. And we also have the moment in this season where he goes to Jerome's house and he's going to poison the dog. And then Jerome, Barbara, and one of Barbara's friends come walking down the street, and he speeds off. And, you know, that whole thing. And we know, because, you know, you and I have read the books, that that piece of meat is going to come back around.
Oh boy, does it. And that, when it does come around, I knew it was going to happen. I was waiting for it to happen, but boy, was that a horrific moment. The way that they filmed it, the way that the actress portrayed the character and the effects was like, it made me nauseous. It just, she's bleeding from her mouth. She bit her tongue after eating this piece of meat. She is just sitting there on the floor. Her eyes are getting more and more bloodshot and bleeding. It is absolutely horrifying.
That scene really impressed me, because I feel like something like that is going to sort of be a make or break moment for a show. Like, if it looks absolutely terrible, it's just going to take you out of the story completely. And then you're going to be like, okay, what's happening? What's going on now? You know, so I felt like they had to absolutely nail that in order for it to work. And they did. It was one of the toughest things to watch in season one by far. And again, his mother, not a great person, you know, hard to feel bad for her, but that was a brutal way to go.
It was a horrifying way to go. I was, and it just kept going. And it's the most in a season that has him mowing down people and running over the sleeping bag and carrying a woman and her child, which is horrific. Somehow this scene, because the camera does not leave it. It is lingering on her face. It is lingering on the horrible situation. It is focusing on the fact that instead of calling 911, he decides to force water down her throat. Instead of doing anything that he could to help his mother, he's instead trying to kind of make it quicker, it seems, in a way, or, you know, do something that's not going to potentially screw up his life. And it's so traumatizing in a way that I was not really expecting.
What I took away from that is the fact that, you know, we talked about how Brady had two jobs, probably could have afforded an apartment. I mean, this is Ohio. It's not like it's New York or something where the rent is absolutely crazy. But it felt like he was shackled to his mother. Like, Brady Hartsfield really felt like Stephen King's Norman Bates.
Mm-hmm.
And he had to kill his mother in order to get his freedom.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the Norman Bates aspect of it, because there's definitely some psycho homages going on here. And yes, I can definitely see him being shackled to his mom and seeing this as like a way of kind of breaking that chain. But then he also doesn't, because instead of like trying to get rid of the body, he brings it up to the bed and starts sleeping next to it. So it's like this person, even in death, he can't escape his mom.
But he does get a little more freedom to do what he wants without her constantly questioning him and that thing. And, you know, definitely very Norman Bates-like with that whole thing.
Yeah.
And even when I was reading the books, I was like, oh, this is what King is alluding to with this character. And it's hard to deny the effect Psycho has had on horror in general, whether it's TV and film or novels. It's just such an iconic piece of work, especially once Hitchcock did it, you know? And I think that is something that's just going to stand the test of time. And a lot of people are going to pull from that as an influence and try to replicate it. And I don't think King ever necessarily tried to replicate it exactly, because that would be pointless and King is smarter than that. But he was definitely saying, this is this character. And the fact that this show took that from the source material and kept it and portrayed it so well really impressed me, because we've seen characters get changed for the small screen and big screen adaptations for better or worse sometimes. You know, Kubrick's The Shining is one that always comes up because of how he changed Jack Torrance from the source material. And, you know, I like that they really just kept the essence of Brady throughout this. And, you know, I don't have a ton more to say about season one. I thought it was fairly well paced. You know, I would have loved a little more overlap with Janie and Holly. I kind of was disappointed with the fact that they didn't use the happy slapper at the end. Instead, it was like this bulldog statue.
Yeah, that was a disappointment for me, because it was such a small little moment in the book, but it's also like, I don't know, there's something very King about it, that it's the happy slapper and it's this sock with what, ball bearings in it, I think, or something. And it did feel kind of like, oh, we're just gonna go with something else. Like, I don't know, it definitely kind of was a disappointment for me as a constant reader and as a fan of that little moment in the book.
And it was such a big, like, heavy object for her to just have in her purse.
Yeah, I know.
But I kind of had a feeling that's what they were going to do when they made it a point to focus on her looking at that in the room and then returning it because she took it, and then him giving it back to her. Like, they made such a big deal about it that you kind of got the feeling
safe.
It was, yeah, going to come back around. But yeah, that was really that. The change of venue and maybe sidelining Barbara were maybe my biggest, it's hard to even call them complaints, because it still does work in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah, I thought this season was really well paced, although I will say that it definitely isn't a show that I recommend binging. I watched two seasons in like a week and a half, so it might have been a little bit of an overkill, but it definitely felt like something that was supposed to be watched paced at a measurably pace, you know, a week to week type thing, as opposed to a show like on Netflix that you just are supposed to sit down and continue to watch. But I think overall it was really well paced, really well acted. I love the characters. I think the actors nailed the characterizations perfectly.
Brendan Gleeson's accent is great.
Oh,
love it.
Love it. Love him. I think he is an underrated and underutilized character actor. And I was happy to see him as sort of like this leading man status in this big television show.
He's also amazing in Paddington 2, in case anyone needs to know.
I need to watch that. I've not seen either Paddington.
Don't let my friend Mitchell hear that. So
I don't let the internet hear that, because it is like, I remember when it got like one negative review on Rotten Tomatoes and the entire internet exploded. So if you're listening to this and you know me, I have watched it. I've seen both. Trust me. Listen, don't worry about it.
Don't even worry about it. Terry, thank you so much for joining me to talk about season one of Mr. Mercedes. You will be back soon for a season two discussion, and you and I will be discussing season three as well. So, you know, we're hitting all three here, but we're separating them out a little, because I do think there are certain things about each season that are worth kind of discussing almost within a vacuum.
Absolutely. And I'm really excited to visit season two, because that's the one of the books that I've not read. So I'm going to be probably having a lot of questions.
All right. That does it for this episode of Chat Cemetery. You can support the podcast on Patreon for $1 a month. You'll get a thank you on the show. For $2 a month, I will send you a Chat Cemetery sticker. And if you want to follow us on social media, you can do so at Chat Cemetery on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You could also rate and review the show. That's a huge help. And as always, thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.